That lines Bahrain's main opposition group and the top clerics strongly denounced the Israeli foreign minister's visit to Manama after a U.S. brokered normalization deal. Israeli troops shoot and kill two Palestinians and injure two others in separate incidents in the occupied West Bank. And COVID-19 cases in Australia's Melbourne surge to record levels despite a hard lockdown that has been in place for nearly 2 months. Hello and welcome, everybody. Bahrain's main opposition group and the top cleric have denounced the kingdom's normalization of relations with the Israeli regime. Bahrain's dissolved opposition party Al-Wefaq said it rejects Israeli Foreign Minister Yair Lapid's visit to Manama. It said any Israeli presence in Bahrain is a provocation to the sentiments of Bahraini, stressing that Lapid must not set foot in Bahrain. Separately, top cleric Sheikh Issa Ahmad Qasim dismissed Manama's normalization of ties with Tel Aviv as despicable and against the will of the Bahraini people. The reactions came as Lapid arrived in Manama, where he is to open the Israeli embassy. Meanwhile, a Bahraini airliner took off for the first commercial flight between Manama and Tel Aviv. Bahrain's Gulf Air airline is to run two flights per week. Bahrain has one of was one of the four Arab states to normalize relations with the Israeli regime under a deal brokered by the U.S. last year. Political commentator Tarek Tahbub believes that attempts by some Arab states to normalize ties with Israel will lead them nowhere, as they lack the support of masses on the issue.
This has been a long process for the past 100 years to bring that Zionist project into the middle of the Arab nation, to divide the Arab nation and to prevent it from attaining its full potential economically, politically, geographically and scientifically. Normalization is not opening the embassies. North Korea and the United States have embassies. And their relation is not normal. Normalization is when you get the well-wishing of the people, you get the acceptance of the people, you get the approval of the people. But cocktail parties and embassies represent nothing. No justice, no peace, no normalization. When justice is achieved and Palestine is given to its rightful people, its rightful owners, population. But if you start an ethnic cleansing, genocidal project like the Zionist project, there is no normalization with that and whatsoever. And someday, all of this who participated in this will be brought to call. They will be, you know, brought to justice.
Israeli forces have fatally shot a young Palestinian woman in occupied Al-Quds. The regime forces claim the woman was hit while trying to stab a soldier near Al-Aqsa Mosque. The victim's identity remains unknown. Separately, a Palestinian man was killed and two others injured after Israeli forces opened fire during their pre-dawn raid in the West Bank town of Burqin. A large crowd of Palestinians attended the funeral of 22-year-old Ala Nasser Zayud. And in the besieged Gaza Strip, a 41-year-old man was killed after he was shot in the head by the regime forces near the Buraj refugee camp. Israel continues its deadly mayhem in the occupied territories under different pretexts on an almost daily basis. Mona Kandil joined us earlier from Ramallah with more details on Israel's latest killings in the occupied territories.
It's the Israeli narration is that a Palestinian woman arrived at one of the gates inside the old town of Jerusalem, Al-Quds Bab al-Silsila, exactly, and she had a knife, and she tried to stab one of the Israeli soldiers there. They opened fire at her, and she was seriously wounded. They left her on the ground, bleeding, and then they searched her. They left her without any allowing anyone to reach her or to help her. Also, another Palestinian was shot dead this morning. Israeli forces raided the village of Burqin, southwest Jenin in the occupied West Bank. They were carrying out an arrest operation. A number of Palestinians were wounded and transferred to Palestinian hospitals. And then it was declared that this Palestinian, a man ala Ziyud, affiliated with the jihad movement, according to the jihad movement in Jenin. Then the Palestinians immediately took part in funeral procession in fear that the Israeli forces might raid the Palestinian hospital to detain his body.
Prominent Nigerian cleric Sheikh Ibrahim Zakzaki says the 2014 massacre in the northern city of Zaria was a pre-planned crackdown by the government.
What happened in Zaria in 2014 was a pre-planned crackdown, even though they have no way to justify what they did, except because they are so confused as to say that there was a blockade of road.
In an exclusive interview with Press TV, Zakzaki said as many as 1,200 people were killed in the carnage and many more were injured. The cleric noted that the Zaria massacre was the worst of its kind but opened the eyes and ears of the people. Zakzaki also said the recent deadly crackdown on the Arbaeen March in the capital Abuja was not justified. Elsewhere in his remarks, Zakzaki said the people of his country will opt for an Islamic democracy if given the choice.
We want democracy, isn't it? What is the meaning of democracy? It is a government of the people. I believe that if there will be a plebiscite in this country where people will be asked, which system would you like? Is it the status quo, which is the heritage of the British colonialists, or the Islamic system? Just cast a vote on one of them. I'm sure a majority will choose Islamic system.
Zakzaki said Nigerian authorities fear of the influence of the Islamic movement in the country. However, he added they should have nothing to fear as the people are after a democratic system. While condemning deadly violence, the cleric underlined that the persecution of Muslims in Nigeria started many years ago. Elsewhere in his remarks, Zakzaki stressed that the 1979 Islamic revolution in Iran had a, quote, tremendous impact on his ideology. He also expressed hope that the oppression of Palestinian people by the Israeli regime will come to an end. We're now joined by Masoud Shajara from the Islamic Human Rights Commission, who's with us from the British capital, London. Mr. Shajara, welcome to the program. A number of issues were mentioned by Sheikh Zakzaki. Please walk us through the most important ones.
Well, I think the fact of the matter that this massacre 2015 was organized and planned, there is really no doubt. All the evidence that we have presented to international court, which as a result of our report, they opened the file, and that file is still going, shows very clearly that that was organized. It took almost 2 days, and the soldiers, the way that they were placed with ammunition and organized and structured, that is not something that comes out of an incident. And the number of people killed, the admission of the mass graves, which resulted in over 1,000 people being killed, sort of totally innocent, totally people with no arms. Their own investigation said that, you know, when they were asked if these people were armed, they said there was one homemade pistol and 47 SIM cards. You know, you don't kill 1,000 people over sort of 48 hours shooting. You know, it really is astonishing. But also the fact of the matter that Islamic movement, it's a peaceful movement fighting on ideology. I think that was very important to be highlighted in this interview. And the fact that, despite the fact that they are not taking arms, but they're not going to give up. As Sheikh said, that you know, until the last breath, they're all going to stand. And the reality is that we are seeing that. And on the other side, you're seeing the brutality by the regime is being sort of implemented day in, day out. And just a couple of days ago in Arbaeen procession, at least 8 people have been killed. And our experience shows that even those who have been injured and taken, or those who are arrested, are not really safe. When in 2014, the Quds Day, many of those who killed, including the children of Sheikh, were actually killed after they were picked up. They were shot after they were picked up. I myself went there and did an extensive sort of investigation, and that's what we find out through sort of eye testimonies and investigation that we gathered. So really, what we need the Nigerian government to stop killing its own people, armless people who are demonstrating peacefully. And we are seeing this happening with a peaceful demonstration of Islamic movement, and we are seeing it with others as well. So the Nigerian regime has got used to going around shooting innocent and armless demonstrators, peaceful demonstrators, and trying to get away with it. And that has to come up to an end.
Mr. Shajidi, you mentioned the 2015 Zaria massacre. There was also, if I'm correct, another deadly crackdown on the Arbaeen March in the capital, Abuja, which was also, in the words of Sheikh Zakzaki, not justified, and he condemned that as well. Who benefits from this sort of crackdown and aggression against the Muslim community in Nigeria?
Well, who benefits, as Sheikh said very clearly, who benefits from chaos? Those who are taking the resources of Nigeria against the interests of Nigerian people. If anybody has gone to Nigeria and you see the level of poverty, the level of corruption, and the level of resources, Nigeria is an oil-producing country. Nigeria has got a huge potential to be a huge economy. It isn't. There is the corruption and all these serving those entities outside who want to manipulate and take the resources of Nigeria. And there are stooges inside Nigeria, those corrupt leaders. It's not strange to see in Nigeria the level of corruption. I remember once Sheikh said to me, most people around the world, when they're corrupt and they're rich, their richness is being leveled and identified as how many planes, the private planes they own. So in Nigeria, people have got private airports. It's true. And if anyone is familiar with Nigeria, Nigerian politicians and those powerful, they sort of brag on how they could break the law. And that sort of is the badge of honor, if that could be identified as showing their boasting about their power. Ordinary people are suffering, and ordinary people are not the beneficiary of what is happening. And the Islamic movement is standing for the ordinary people, whatever background they are, from whichever community. And it's saying that, this system is abusive, is failing, is broken down, and we need to replace it with something that stands for justice for all. And I think that was extremely well articulated by Sheikh.
All right, thanks a lot. Masoud Shajada joining us from the British capital, London. Thank you for your comments. The number of daily coronavirus cases in Australia's second largest city, Melbourne, has hit a record high. Officials in the capital, Victoria State, reported 1,438 new cases, the largest one-day tally since the start of the pandemic. The surge comes despite 2 months of lockdown on the city to contain the disease. The peak in infections is set to be linked to ongoing street protests, illegal gatherings, and house parties on the Australian Football League's grand final. Meanwhile, police were seen patrolling the streets to impose the restrictions. Australia has reported more than 105,000 cases and over 1,200 related deaths so far. New South Wales and Victoria states remain the hardest hit. And Russia's daily coronavirus fatalities have set a new record amid a spike in infections. The country reported 867 deaths from COVID-19 in the past 24 hours, bringing the overall toll to well over 206,000. Authorities also registered nearly 24,000 new cases. That takes the total caseload to nearly 7.5 million. The capital, Moscow, remains the epicenter of the outbreak, which is largely blamed on the Delta variant of the virus. A slow vaccination drive has also worsened the situation. Less than 30% of the Russian population has so far been fully vaccinated. British officials say the fuel shortage that sparked nationwide panic and chaos over the past week is back under control. Chief Secretary of the Treasury Simon Clark said he hoped the crisis would continue to ease. Earlier, the British Business Ministry announced it would boost fuel deliveries in the coming days. The government also took a series of measures aimed at stabilizing the crippling fuel shortage that started a week ago. The country has since witnessed panic buying and long queues outside petrol stations. The shortage was caused by lack of truckers to deliver the petrol, a problem intensified amid Brexit and the coronavirus pandemic. Our correspondent in London, Amina Taylor, says British officials claim that the fuel crisis is easing is just to portray a normal situation ahead of the Conservatives' conference this weekend.
If you listen to Grant Shapps, who's the Transport Secretary, he lays this firmly at the feet of the haulage industry, which he says were quite keen to use cheaper foreign labor to undercut British jobs. Now, these are some of these same individuals, this three-month visa scheme from the government, are trying to entice back into the country in order to help alleviate this shortage. Now, when the Chief Treasury Minister says the situation is becoming more under control, well, he perhaps is talking more in terms of what they'd like to see. What I passed on my way from the nursery run this morning were still queues outside a petrol station that would have one or two cars as a maximum in every few minutes. So the idea here that he can sit in Westminster and say things are pretty much on their way to normal is astonishing. And let's not forget why the optics are important to the government. The Conservative Party has its main, its marquee showpiece event over the weekend, and that will be the Conservative Party conference. Now, if you're going to be the Prime Minister or the Chancellor of the Exchequer or the Business Secretary, addressing the nation whilst people can't get their hands on the most fundamental of products to get from A to B and to make sure their businesses are up and running, what does that tell you about the way in which you handle things?
That's a wrap for now. Bye, everybody.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Stark Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayaki. In today's show, we're discussing A Revolution in Four Seasons, directed by Jesse Dieter. And joining me in the studio, we have Carol Allen, who writes for CloseUpFilm.com, Movies One, and is an editor and film critic for AEA Digest. And beside her is Catherine Shakdam, who is a political analyst and director of the Shakbakhna Institute of Middle Eastern Studies. Now, A Revolution in Four Seasons tells the story of two women with opposing political views fighting for different futures in Tunisia, the country that sparked the Arab Spring. Though, as this documentary shows, there are many unexpected challenges that lay ahead in trying to fight for a better future for your country.
We can little by little show the drawbacks of drinking alcohol, the drawbacks of wearing bikini.
I was the first person from this village to be elected in the parliament. Our people are waiting us to start writing the constitution.
They wrote one article of the constitution.
There's a change since the revolution. Now the Tunisian society is divided.
I could have been in the United States, but you put me in Tunisia because you have this crazy idea that this country can be a democracy.
Welcome both of you to the show. Thank you very much, ladies, for coming on. And so this documentary takes you on a journey into the lives of two very different Tunisian women, and who both embrace the revolution but have completely different visions for the future of their country. Carol, if I could start with you as our guest film critic, what was your take on A Revolution in Four Seasons?
Well, it was interesting and important to see the world of two women from a very different country, as I said, very different point of view, with whom we have more in common than we might think. I don't want to go too far ahead, but at one point, for example, both of them get married, they have their first babies, they both have to cope with a problem which is universal for women throughout the world: how do you have your place in the world and still fulfill your duties as a wife and mother? And interestingly, it is Jawara, the more conventionally Muslim lady, who solves it most easily in that she is involved in politics. She's a member of the Constituent Assembly, which is writing the Constitution. And her husband, he helps her a lot. The other woman, Emna,
who's a secularist in the film.
She is a secularist. Well, she is a Muslim, I think, in that she observes the fasting rules, but she doesn't wear the hijab. Right.
Which is so very she wants easy to see a difference between religion and the rule of the country.
Yes, she wants a more she wants, as it says in the trailer, a state which is like Sweden or France, mm-hmm. whereas the other lady is a member of the Islamic Democratic Party, and she wants an Islamic state which is still democratic, which is a concept we in the West probably find quite difficult because we tend to think Islamic, and we're very wary of it. So it was a very positive film from that point of view.
And quite refreshing to see that.
Yeah, Jawara, she really impressed me. I thought she was she's a lovely, intelligent, thoughtful woman. She's not a scary Islamist at all. I'd like her to be my friend.
Catherine, I'd like to bring you in here. What was your take on the documentary?
I found it very interesting. I mean, to be fair with you, I didn't expect that I would actually enjoy it because, you know, I thought it was going to be one of those, you know, movie on the so-called Arab Spring. But what I found particularly interesting is that you have those two women who, you know, at the beginning of the documentary, you expect to be kind of, you know, on the opposite side of the river, I would say. They're actually quite similar in their hope for Tunisia, which is essentially to empower the people and have a system that represents, you know, the people but doesn't betray, you know, their identity. And I think that, you know, the issue here is really identity, is how does, you know, an Islamic or self-identified Islamic country find itself, you know, not just within the region, but within, you know, I would say, you know, this desire to be democratic and this desire to function, you know, within the international community,
It is an interesting point that this documentary raises, that democracy is different for different people.
Exactly.
And has different interpretations.
I think for me that was the core issue, that, you know, it's maybe not talked about, but it's there, where, you know, you have, you know, someone who wants to have a secular democracy, you know, like France, where, you know, the state and religion are quite separate, which is fine. And then, you know, you have the other point of view, where she talks a lot about, you know, identity, how not to betray your heritage and your tradition. I think this is something that hasn't been talked about, this necessity for the Islamic world to actually have a democracy that looks like them, rather than looks like a Western democracy. We need to understand that there are more than just one way to be democratic. I don't think they're that different. I think they're very different in their approach to democracy or how they would like to formulate it, but they come across the same issues, where, you know, secularism is really good on paper to some extent, but then there's issues attached to that. And then the same thing when it comes to Islamism, where, you know, there was a lot of issues. I mean, when you talk about terrorism, for example, or how there was this...
Actually, we're going to touch on that a bit later on. Yeah.
When you think that in order for me to be a progressive, I have to look like the Western people, to eat like them, to think like them, to have the same taste, this harms not only our identity, but the human identity itself. You cannot be just a subordinate to France or to the United States and forget about your religion, forget about your history, forget about your language, even your language, in order to be just to be progressive, I think.
Carol, you mentioned a bit earlier how you were surprised to see, as a Westerner, a Muslim woman, a strong Muslim woman, getting involved in politics. And she also has a strong family life, and her husband stays at home. What was this like, watching this for you?
Well, as I said earlier, it was a bit of an eye-opener. I mean, that particular point you raised there about the political woman, who is well supported by her Islamic, her Muslim husband, whereas the French-speaking woman who wants to be eminent, who wants to be like Sweden or France. Her husband, who has spent a lot of time in America, behaves pretty much like a Western bloke. He goes into politics and leaves her at home holding the baby, with her life on hold.
And you can see their relationship became strained, whereas
yes.
The others didn't.
Yes. I mean, it is actually a very good PR for the idea of an Islamic state which is not repressive and which can be democratic. In fact, the clip we just saw was reiterating the points that Catherine just made.
Mm-hmm. And Catherine, what do you think? Do you think this documentary shows the positive side of Muslims?
Well, it shows definitely that, first of all, number one, there is a space for women in politics and Islam. So this is not, you know, the two don't have to clash. And, you know, this idea that, for example, that women should not enter politics, I think is linked to, you know, Wahhabism, Salafism, radical Islam, basically, where it's Islam is being deconceptualized. It's taken away from its context, and it doesn't mean anything anymore. But what you see here is very interesting, because she's, you know, she's hammering on the idea of identity. And again, I think that it's, you know, we need to listen to what she's saying, because it's just, you know, it's a neo-colonial reaction, I would say, where, you know, whether she's right or wrong, there is this idea that the West is trying to impose a certain socio-political model, and there's a reaction against it, because people want to find their own way through democracy. And I think that if we want to have a real discussion on how we move forward in the Middle East, how we could enable and accompany those countries to actually find, you know, their way and be democratic, we have to make sure that we don't impose any particular model. And, you know, if you look at Iran, for example, which is I know that people will say, no, it's not, but it is a very progressive society. I think it's a perfect example of that, where it doesn't feel the constraint of colonialism. Mm-hmm. It doesn't need to be to identify itself against it. And I think that's what you see in Tunisia, is that Tunisia was, you know, recently, I mean, historically speaking, recently freed or independent from France. And yet you see how France is very much, you know, impacting the way that they think themselves forward in politics. And, you know, I think that the Islamists tapped into it, reacted against it, and somehow, I would say, you know, played it to their advantage. So it was a very good PR stunt, as you mentioned. But of course, you know, some of them were genuine, some of them less so. And so, you know, we saw the abuses that it led to. But again, I'm going to say that, for example, it took France 5 republics, 2 empires, and a failed monarchy to, you know, to finally be a democracy. So I think we need to give it time. You know, we need to understand that you don't become a democratic state.
I think
nice.
Yeah, we're going to discuss more the future and the problems of the country that it faced.
The goal is to train community organizers. We believe that it's very important to have independent representatives in the Constituent Assembly elections. We're doing it Obama style, actually, here, you know, grassroots movement.
So I'd like to talk about the secularist movement in the documentary now, with Emma, who is supporting a secular country for Tunisia. And Carol, what are some of the struggles that she faced in the pursuit of power?
Some of the struggles that she faces? Her chief campaign seems to be, her chief issue seems to be with the police, who don't appear to be democratic at all. And this is, you know, this is something which is not just a problem in Tunisia. The personal issues I mentioned earlier about coping with being a person, an effective person in the outside world, and with her baby. I actually found her, I have to admit, a less interesting character than Jawahara.
Oh, really? Why is
that? But what is interesting as well, I knew very little about the history of Tunisia, really, until the Arab Spring happened. Again, an eye-opener for Westerners is we tend to think an Islamic state is going to be repressive, a secular state isn't. Well, in this instance, the dictator Ben Ali, was it?
Yes.
He was a secularist. And when we come to the elections, the fear is that the secular party is going to bring back another dictator. So the point that Catherine was making earlier about not imposing our view, our Western view of democracy, on other countries is very important, because we do tend to think, well, we've got it right. And you know, in the case of Britain, we had an empire, we had colonies, we know how to run things. And you actually have to respect what is there. It's quite natural for human beings to want more independence, to want a more democratic state. But I think they have to find their own way of doing it. And it rather looks like Tunisia is doing this now.
Do you think it's in a better state now? I mean, do you get a sense from the documentary that before the revolution it was in a bad state?
I get the sense from the documentary. I'm not always clear from the documentary what exactly was going on in Tunisia before. For example, Jawahara refers to the fact that women have had the vote for a long time. Then we get a caption with the first lot of elections in the documentary. This is the first time there have been free elections ever in this country. And can you explain that?
Yes,
I
wanted to ask Catherine,
well,
actually. Could you give us
Well, women were given, you know, the right to vote. I can't remember when. It was quite early on. I think it was the 1950s or something, you know, because of France. And then, you know, when Tunisia became independent, it kind of carried on. And as you mentioned, Ben Ali was very, I would say, you know, secular, very progressive, at least, you know, by France's standards, and which is why he was, you know, quite well-liked by the French government. There's a difference in between, you know, where all people can vote and they actually have a right to say something. And I think this is the problem here, is that it's not because you live in a secular, you know, republic, for example, that you actually have a say in anything. And I think that's what they refer to. And the sad thing is that I get the sense that, you know, somehow both of them felt that their revolution, you know, the way that they imagined themselves to become free, was taken away from them, you know, for different reasons. So, you know, secularism didn't happen the way Emna wanted. And then, you know, for the other lady, it's, you know, she felt, I think, betrayed by this move towards, you know, radicalism, where there was an imposition of certain views, where she hoped that it was more an invitation to. And I think this is the main problem here.
And I wanted to mention another part in the documentary where Jawahara gave a powerful speech in Parliament talking about how they have to smash the stereotypes and work together. What did you make of that scene?
Well, I admired the power of her speech. That wasn't the scene that made the biggest impression on me, though. One that did, which is, again, very important to the image of Islam in the West, was at the end, towards the end, because terrorism isn't mentioned very much in the film, although I understand it is a problem that there was...
Both facing the Muslims and the secularists.
Yeah,
country.
I mean...
Isn't just the Muslim problem? Indeed.
But there is a terrorist incident towards the end of the film, and Jawahara says, this is awful, this is not what my father taught me, this is not what is in the Quran, we must fight it.
Terrorism is in the heart of the capital. It's in Bardo. It's in the museum, next to the parliament. And especially I was there as a deputy, and I was there as an ordinary citizen. This is not the Islam I belong to. This is not the Islam that my father teaches me, and this is not the Islam that I read in the Quran. I can't read any verse in the Quran that justifying what they are doing now. It's a religion which preaches tolerance, which preaches peace. Then we have to fight them.
That was a really moving moment in the documentary, that fight for struggle. I mean, you get the sense that the revolution was in fact the easy part, and the problem lies in rebuilding the country. Is that the impression you got also?
Yes, and isn't that always the problem with revolutions? It's all very well to tear something down, but then you have to find the right way of building something up. And another point that that lady made earlier in the film was the difficulty of reconciling being an idealist with being a politician. And that, again, is another universal point that she's making there.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, it's a very human story that this documentary tells also. And so 6 years on, Catherine, from the Arab Spring, what problems still persist in the country? So briefly there was an issue of terrorism. Yeah.
Well, I think Tunisia, interestingly enough, I mean, started it off, and it's a blueprint. But it's a compounding of everything, all the issues that other countries in the Middle East are facing right now, which is terrorism. The discussion, secularism, Islamism. Where do we do? Could we find another way? I think her silence, speaks volume really, and it's really moving, because what do you say in the face of radicalism? What do you say before terrorism? Terrorism doesn't speak for any religion. So, here's Islam, but, it could be Christianity, Judaism, Buddhism, it doesn't matter. There is no religion that, preaches, violence. It's just ludicrous. It's a political construct. And I think that what you have here is the desire, is this attempt to have pluralism. And this is what I heard, throughout the documentary.
Acceptance and tolerance.
Yes, that people need to find a way to live together, to find a way to disagree, but not hate each other. You can hate each other's ideas. It doesn't mean you have to hate each other and enact on that hatred. And I think this is the main issue that you have, is that people have been taught, for whatever reason, that they need to live in this kind of binary construct where they have to be either, on this side or that side, hate each other or love each other. It doesn't have to be this way. And I think that a lot has to do with the way that the revolution was spoken out in the media. That kind of imprinted this idea, again, that they have to be against each other. Clearly, those two women have very similar paths. Even like I said, they're sitting on different sides of the river. But again, they're facing the same challenges. They just approach them differently.
And Carol, would you agree, is there a lot of misinformation in the mainstream media?
I think there probably is. Of course, I'm not in a position to know what's false and what's not. But yes, Catherine is absolutely right when she says that we can live together with different viewpoints. I hate what you say, but I will defend to the death your right to say it. And that's what we need to actually get, not just in Tunisia and not just in the UK, but throughout the world.
And this is one of the most powerful messages you get from the documentary.
Yes, yes.
We're nearing the end of the film and this programme now, and I'm just wondering, what would you have liked to see in the documentary also?
What would I... Well, I would have liked a little bit more explanation of the context. I got a little bit confused. I was very aware there was a Democratic Islamic Party because Joël Aarav was part of it. They were taking a heck of a long time over writing the constitution, somebody pointed out. A bit like Brexit, really. and then suddenly, when the president, or was he the prime minister, I can't remember, decided to cede and say, OK, we'll have another election. Suddenly the constitution was in place. I didn't realise how quickly that could be. So there were certain things about clarity which I would...
So would you recommend the film, final 30 seconds to
you? Oh, yes, I'd be very interested. It's American. I don't know where it's been shown in America. It's a sort of film that might crop up on BBC 4 or Channel 4 or something here. And I think it would be an interesting one for us all to watch.
We'll have to leave it there. Thank you very much, ladies, for coming on Doc Review. And that's it for this episode. Thanks to both my guests and to you. I've been Camila Shambiati, and see you on the next episode of Doc Review.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
وَقَضَى رَبُّكَ أَلَّا تَعْبُدُوا إِلَّا إِيَّاهُ وَبِالْوَالِدَيْنِ إِحْسَانًا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
For humanity.
Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi.
A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytan ar-rajim. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to IRIB English Radio, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. When corruption happens on a social level or political level, there are consequences, there are effects that harms the rights of people, be it on a state level or on a global level. So I want to look at some of the side effects, the bad side effects of corruption on a political level. Political corruption leads to, or it disturbs, public order in the country. Recently, when I watched the news, in a lot of countries, when there are corruption happening, for example, in the parliament, or the prime minister or the president of the country is corrupted, you see there's disruption happening when it comes to order in that state or in that country, where people take matters in their own hands, where people start to revolt. For example, you've seen in many countries, in France, for example, in America, in England, in the Middle East, in Hong Kong, Chinese, they would love to, but they can't. They get suppressed very quickly. So you can see that happening, where people, in fact, when it comes to law and order, they taking matters in their own hands. So the public order, that which me and you, we live under, that is supposed to provide us with security, that's supposed to provide us with safety, it doesn't exist anymore. So I don't feel safe in my own country. I don't feel safe in my own place. So what do I tend to do? Create a sense of distraction, create a sense of havoc. Me, my friends, and we sat, you know, as you see in many countries through Facebook, social media, they go to the streets and they burn and they break and they steal. Recently, if you guys are watching the news in South Africa, for example, where people lost their trust in the government, for example, and they went to the streets and they start burning and looting and and all that sort of things were happening because, I don't know, the government decided to imprison the previous or the former president of the country. So people, when sense of corruption happens, there will be disruption. It will disrupt public order in that country. And that's not something that we should look at lightly. It also, corruption also weakens the legitimacy and authority of the state. I mean, I would question the authority and, you know, how legitimate it is. And it shows me how weak it is when the members of such a system themselves are corrupted and the system itself is not doing anything about it. And in some states that I've seen, they have a system or they have a body, a government body, where it was meant to look at those who create corruption within the government and question them and bring them to justice. But in fact, even that body itself is corrupted. So if I was a corrupted politician, I would pay someone off in this department that was meant to monitor me, and I can get away with it. So it is really, it loses that sense of legitimacy, and it really weakens that state, and it provides, a ground for unrest in that country because the system is corrupted, the people are corrupted, everything falls apart. And that's just a minor side effect of corruption that happens in society. Now, let us take a small break and then we come back and we continue.
Dear listeners, you are listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are still listening to IRIB English Radio, and we are looking at human rights. And especially when corruption happens, we said human rights goes out of the door. So when corruption happens on the political level, it creates a sense of destabilization and instability in that system itself. Where, for example, you see in many countries, due to the government being corrupted, the president would change the cabinet and he would relieve the previous government out of its role, and they appoint a temporarily government. And then for months and months, they might bring another group of people, and those people themselves might also be corrupted as well, and so on and so forth. So you see that the state itself, the political system, is unstable. It's not stabilized, which it will affect the lives of people. So, for example, when you look at Lebanon and you see how the system is unstable because they keep changing governments every 6 months or every year frequently, the country almost collapsing now. The currency is collapsed. The economy is collapsed. Everything is collapsed. Because whenever a new bunch of people come into power, all they think of is how much can I steal before I am replaced within the next 6 months or 12 months. So instead of them trying to fix the mistakes of the previous government, they create problems of their own before they leave. Because this is what corruption happens. And then you can see the majority of the people, the rest of the people, trying to trying to afford staying alive. They can't afford to buy food. They can't afford to put petrol in their cars. They can't afford, to take the kids to school and so on and so forth. Only because on the political level, the corruption is so high that it affecting their livelihood. And this is if we look at it from a state level or a country level. But when we look at it even globally, when corruption happens on a global level from the political arena, many countries, many societies falls apart. many societies goes, they go hungry. They don't have the most fundamental basic rights. They don't even have water, for example, to drink, or food to eat, or a shelter, for example. Only because on the political level, there is such a state of corruption happening that people end up even losing their lives in the process. You can see, for example, in countries where if the countries are oppressive in their nature, for example, either the people, the citizens of this country themselves, they end up being dead or killed by that state, or they end up fleeing and migrating to another state. And you will see that, for example, other states, they support the action of that state as well. So when the corruption happens in that level, then me and you will suffer. Me and you will feel, as we say, we will feel the heat. We will feel the wrath of poverty. We will feel the wrath of being deprived and not having anything. It even sometimes it strips us of our identity, of who we are, where we came from, our heritage. All goes away because there's corruption happening on the political arena that deprives me and you of our essentials. So it is very necessary, it's very important for any government that is in power to be stable, to be a non-corrupted body. So it creates that sense of security, that sense of safety for its citizens. Otherwise, we will have lots and lots of problems. We leave it here. We continue in episodes to come. Until then, stay with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. وعلى آل النبي أجمعين فبهم نرجوك أحسن ختمنا.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.